are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Jeff Gehrman, a veteran Las Vegas Review-Journal investigative reporter, was no stranger to controversy or the danger of his work. For more than four decades, he wrote stories relentlessly confronting the mob, corrupt politicians, and greedy bureaucrats. As a result, he was often threatened, enough that he and his friend and fellow investigative reporter, Arthur Kane, sometimes joked about reporting on these threats if they were ever acted upon. Then, in the spring of 2022, Gehrman received a tip about abuses at a little-known county office. His subsequent investigation unearthed a scandalous, sexually incriminating video of a rising politician. The resulting stories in the Review-Journal ended the man's political aspirations. Less than 6 months later, on September 3rd, Gehrman's lifeless body was discovered outside his home with multiple stab wounds. His dedicated newsroom colleagues, including Kane, vowed to find the killer. In doing so, they exposed the true depths of corruption and malice in Sin City. Meanwhile, the police struggled to identify a suspect until they released a photo of the suspect's vehicle to the media. That tip led them to none other than the small-time politician, who was subsequently arrested and now faces life in prison, pending the outcome of his trial in August 2024. In the last story, Kane delivers an intense narrative of courage, betrayal, and the unrelenting quest for justice. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Last Story, The Murder of an Investigative Journalist in Las Vegas, with my special guest, investigative journalist and author, Arthur Kane. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Arthur Kane.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Thank you so much, and congratulations on your new book, The Last Story.
I appreciate that.
Now, just to open, you and Jeff Gehrman worked together as journalists, and you and Jeff used to talk about a promise to each other in jest. Tell us, before we start, about that promise.
It was kind of the newsroom gallows humor. You know, one time I'd had a story that was a pretty good story that ended up getting constable here indicted, and he came up to my desk and said, "Hey, you better watch your back. That guy's going to come and get you." And I said, "Hey, you better write about it if it happens, right?" And so every time one of us would have a hard-hitting investigation that got results, the other one would kind of do that as a compliment without getting too mushy and as a kind of a joke or gallows humor. So about a week before I met him at the paper, we had met to talk about a story. He had just done a story that had resulted in someone losing their reelection. And so we went through that whole monologue or exchange together.
Now, give us your background and when you arrived in Las Vegas, and then also what you learned in writing this book, but also just learning about your colleague, Jeff Gehrman.
So I started at the RJ at the end of 2016 and was a reporter with Jeff. He was the first person on the investigative team, and I was the second person. He had been an internal candidate. I was hired from the outside. Basically worked pretty closely for about 6 or 7 years, did a lot of investigations together. I think we taught each other a lot. He was kind of old school guy, and we liked to work phones and sources, and I'm kind of public records and data guy. And so we kind of complemented each other in our reporting. So it was pretty much working with him on stories and by myself, and he would work on stories by himself too. But we collaborated on four or five big investigations that got some pretty decent results.
You talk about the history of the Las Vegas Review-Journal, and right away there was had many owners over the years, but there is an owner that raises quite a bit of controversy. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so in 2015, the paper was purchased by the wealthiest person in Nevada and one of the wealthiest people in the world, Sheldon Adelson, who owned the Venetian at the time and the Palazzo, two of the biggest casinos on the Strip. He was one of the biggest Republican donors. Him and his wife had contributed a lot of money to Republicans. The controversy kind of began because there was an attempt from him to kind of hide his ownership of the paper, and the reporters at the paper ended up uncovering it and reporting who bought the paper. It wasn't the best start for them, but since then they've been pretty good about investing money into the paper, and it's become a pretty, I think their resources have definitely improved the product and the paper, and definitely allow us to have a big investigative team, which some papers are getting rid of.
You talk about Jeff Gehrman and his tenure as a journalist in Las Vegas for almost 40 years before his death, but he didn't start at the Review Journal, the Las Vegas Review Journal. He started at the Las Vegas Sun. So tell us about his career, just briefly, the kinds of cases that he was very interested in and the kinds of stories that he did end up breaking.
Yeah, he graduated from Marquette with a master's degree and came right to Vegas, worked at the Sun for a couple of, I think, three decades, was a columnist, an investigative reporter there, a courts reporter, did some politics coverage and stuff like that. And you know, broke some pretty big stories about the mob, broke stories about corruption in government. I had some tussles, got punched one time by a guy who was collecting, who was a court bailiff, but he was also collecting money for the sheriff campaign and also for a bookie. And Jeff was writing about him, and the guy, and they confronted each other in a at a bar, and the guy ended up punching Jeff. But Jeff kept writing about him after that. He wasn't cowed by that. And so he spent quite a bit of time at the Sun, and then he was laid off, even though he was a very prominent journalist. And then he came to the RJ in 2010 as a courts reporter, and then was promoted to investigations right about the time that, right before the time I joined it in 2016.
You write about the unique situation in Las Vegas, given its seedy background of mob organized crime history in Las Vegas, the building of Las Vegas itself, but then also the influence of organized crime currently at the time that Jeff was reporting for the Review Journal and the Sun about its influence on politicians and all kinds of elected officials in the Las Vegas area.
Well, yeah, I think that was, you know, Jeff was about 15, 20 years older than me. So in the 80s, I was in elementary school or junior high when he was doing all this reporting. But what really struck me in my research was how much the mob, and if not the mob, people with severe major criminal backgrounds, people who had been accused of killing people, people who've been accused of all kinds of crimes, were basically part of the establishment here. You would have someone like Benny Binion, who had been suspected in five murders in Texas and fled because the sheriff who was protecting him who voted out of office, fled to Vegas to escape prosecution, having regular lunches with a federal judge who was here, right? And so it was really the corruption was just kind of part, you know, they were the elite, the people who we would think of as criminals now, were the elite, and everybody kowtowed to them from the governor on down to the DA and all these other people. And so it was a very interesting situation. I can't imagine something like that in that time. I mean, obviously you probably had stuff like that in Chicago and in the, you know, 20s and 30s, things like that. But in America, it was a pretty unique situation, a very, very eye-opening for me, who didn't really, I mean, I knew there was a mob history, but I didn't realize how influential and how much they were in society in Vegas until I started reporting this book.
You talked about the Binion and also that Jeff Gehrman reported on mob cases like the Ted Binion case. But you also explained that, of course, American journalists don't have the same fear factor that you write about, that journalists in Russia and Mexico and the threats, the imminent death threats that those journalists face is very, very rare, and deaths of journalists, murders of journalists is very, very rare in America. But that also that Jeff had established himself as a respected journalist that could criticize mob figures and still be considered doing just his job.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about it is that obviously if you look at, and I did an analysis of the Committee to Protect Journalist data, if you look at certain countries, there are dozens or hundreds of journalists killed every year for what they're writing. Here you've got a dozen or so killed, and almost all of them were by, you know, gangsters or criminals, or five of them were killed in a mass shooting, which is just now part of the fabric of society now. And it was a disgruntled reader, you know, who walked into a newspaper. Fortunately, and I hope we keep it that way, or even reduce it, but it's very rare for a journalist to fear physical retribution. There's a lot of otherwise retribution where people are trying to get you fired or deplatformed or something like that. But as far as fearing for your life, it's pretty rare. And so for something, you know, for journalists to be murdered in America is still a huge story. I mean, we were flooded with requests from every paper and every TV station after Jeff's death in the country, and probably some international stuff. So it's definitely a unique story here, and we hope to keep it very unique.
Now, Jeff was dealing with some stories right up to his death, and you and Jeff had worked on a story just recently before his death. So tell us what you were working on and the last story that you worked on with Jeff.
The last story we worked on together was a couple of years before. We started it right around the time of the pandemic. So it took a little while longer because there's all this pandemic stuff that we were doing, but separately. But we did a story about the former Clark County coroner who we had found was, you know, it looked like he was using his vacation time, but then not logging it. So he was able to cash it out. He was traveling around the country giving speeches about the October 1 mass shooting, which I think everybody's familiar with, the Mandalay Bay shooting.
Right.
And he was taking paid speeches when he wasn't taking, we were supposed to take vacation time if they were paid. But during that whole time, his whole office ended up being, I guess, a nest of sexual harassment and inappropriate conduct. But there wasn't anyone really, it looked like from our reporting, that there wasn't someone minding the store. And so we had done three or four big stories about that right around the time. We started right around the time of COVID, and it was probably in about a year before his death is when we did those stories. But we had met to talk about another story we had worked on together was about a councilwoman named Michelle Fiore that he had been covering a lot. That's the reason we met right before his death, was to talk about whether we wanted to work on some other stuff he had found about her. That's the first time I'd seen him since COVID started in person. We had some Zooms and we had lots of phone calls, but that was the first time we got together in person for a couple of years.
Let's talk about now Labor Day 2022, and executive editor Glenn Cook gets a call from Police Sheriff Joe Lombardo. Now, what's the call about? What do you have to say?
So, yeah, it was a Saturday right before Labor Day, long weekend. He gets a call from Lombardo, and Lombardo says, "I'm calling about Jeff Gehrman. Do you know what I'm calling about?" And Glenn was helping his son with some homework, assumed it was about a story because police and the RJ have a pretty contentious relationship. And so he assumed it was something Jeff was working on, but it was strange because Jeff was really good about keeping all of his editors updated. And so he couldn't remember a hard-hitting story about Lombardo, the police department. And at the time, Lombardo was running for governor, which he ended up successfully becoming governor. And so he was kind of racking his brain. And then the sheriff blurts out Jeff's dead. And of course, you know, Jeff was 69 years old. He'd had some health problems. So the first thing your mind comes to is, oh my God, he had some sort of a medical issue and he is, you know, collapsed or something like that. And so the sheriff was really kind of coy about the whole situation, didn't really say much. They said, well, he's at the coroner. We're trying to find out what happened. He was really scratched up, things like that. And so that was the Saturday. And then later on, there was a press conference about a murder in Jeff's neighborhood. And one of the editors looked and said, oh my God, that murder is a block away from where Jeff's body was found in front of his house. And so at that point, we realized that it wasn't someone scratched up. It was basically a homicide. And that took a whole different, you know, obviously tone for people. And it was a much, much, much more, you know, story. The story was much bigger now. It had been a murder instead of a fatality based on health or some other reason. It was a homicide. And so everybody kind of jumped on that story right away and tried to figure out what happened.
You're right that the police have a hearing or a briefing and not much information is released, but in subsequent days, there is a fair amount of information, especially given about now the coroner has decided that this is a homicide. So tell us what you and the other people at the newspaper learn about Jeff Gehrman's murder.
Well, I mean, it didn't take a coroner to find out. He was stabbed 7 times in the neck and chest. So there was no doubt that it was a homicide, and we actually knew about it. We called, you know, the leadership called sheriff back, and he confirmed after we knew about the press conference that Jeff was who they suspect a murder. So, but it was a whodunit at that point because, you know, Jeff had upset a lot of people. It also, police were acting like, well, this could be a personal thing where he has some sort of a personal relationship with this person, because they always jump to that instantly, is if someone is killed there, did they have is that a girlfriend boyfriend situation, or is this a jilted husband or something? You know, it was really kind of a whodunit. Obviously, we knew some of the stories he was working on, and we one of the editors gave the police a list of the stories he had been working on. But I personally was hearing from my sources that this was probably something like either a robbery gone wrong or some sort of a personal thing and not really related to his work. And then they release a video of a guy in a big hat that looks like a landscaper or a construction worker. There's a lot of road work going on right north of Jeff's house. So he fits in with all the people who are walking around there with that and a big sun hat. You know, it's hot. It's 100 plus degrees. They have to protect themselves from the sun. So the first thing we get is a video of this guy walking around the neighborhood that they say is a suspect, but they don't know who he is. They can't see his face. It was kind of a whodunit, and we were obviously interested in who it was, and everybody was interested. It was the biggest story of town, but we didn't really have anything but theories at that point. Then at one point so police are pretty tight-lipped about cases where they know what's going on, but this case was a whodunit for them. So they every day they'd had a press conference and they would release some more information. And then at one point they released a maroon, older Denali type of SUV truck that was driving in the neighborhood, and they said was driven by the suspect. They got a text from someone in the county who said, hey, the public administrator who Jeff had written about has access to just such a truck. And about the same time, one of our assistant city editors had gotten a text from a source saying, hey, look at this. There's a truck just like that in front of the public administrator, this guy named Robert Tayes, in front of the public administrator's house. And then at that point, it really got interesting and just crazy, because if the public administrator was a suspect in Jeff's murder, that was probably the first time in 70 years that a journalist was allegedly killed by a public government elected official. That's when the story really ramped up, and we kind of just hit the ground running.
You immediately thought it sounded sort of insane for somebody to do something like that over an article that it already been published. You thought maybe for a pending article that would be ruinous, but in this case, it was the article had already been published. Now, getting to investigate this Robert Tayes, you go back and the newspaper goes back to the cases that he was working on. They obviously was one of them was Robert Tayes, but you go back to all of the confrontation, the tapes, the all the footage that they have, and look at his behavior and his reaction to Jeff German's articles in the paper.
Yeah, I mean, he so basically what happened is Jeff had written a couple of stories about this guy being inappropriate, kind of a bad boss thing, you know, verbally abusive towards people, moving people for no reason, just being a bully at work. And on top of that, his employees in his office had caught him on video in the back seat of SUV with one of his subordinates, but both of whom were married. And so after that story ran, there was a primary where he lost his primary and was going to be out of office by the end of the year. After that, he had sent some texts, some tweets out, basically making fun of Jeff. It wasn't threatening in that I'm going to come get him. It was kind of going, doesn't Jeff have anything better to do? Jeff's looking through my garbage, which he obviously wasn't, but he was joking. And when he finds the sushi containers and the pizza container, he's going to say I'm part of the Yakuza and part of the mob. And so it was just him kind of blowing off steam, which happens a lot in stories that, you know, are true. And we find somebody who has public foibles and they don't like those exposed. But nothing there would have indicated any kind of a threat, or else we would have taken precautions. And so it was definitely surprising for everyone to think that was a suspect. And you know, a few days later, he ends up getting arrested for the murder.
You wrote about the photos that they have and that the police release. And you said a big floppy hat to protect against 110 degrees that these guys were working in. But he didn't have construction boots, and he had designer jeans, and he had runners, he had sneakers. So when they did get a search warrant for his house, what did they find?
Well, they found the hat had been cut up but and stashed in the garage. They found one of the sneakers cut up and one of them, I assume, probably being ready to cut up. They found the bag that looked a lot like what the suspect was wearing. They found, so basically what it looked like is that they never found the knife that was used in the homicide, but they basically, for some reason, if he is convicted of this, and he hasn't gone to trial, so we don't know that he is the person who did this, but if he's convicted for this, there's a real question of why he got rid of the knife, but kept the, you know, shoes with blood on them and the hat that was, you know, had the same little vent holes that they see on the video and all this other stuff. So there's some real questions about why he just didn't dispose of them in the same way that he disposed of the knife, because no one knows where the knife is.
Very interesting. We haven't mentioned that the footage that he was caught on, which didn't recognize his face, couldn't really show his face, but it was interesting that he left the premises. He was parked across the street. He left, but then came back. And it looked like just a check to make sure that Garriman was actually dead.
Oh yeah, if it was him or whoever did it, there's definitely surveillance video from the neighbor across the street of him leaving and then a few seconds later driving back. So he parked the car outside of Jeff's cul-de-sac, or the SUV outside of Jeff's cul-de-sac. He goes behind Jeff's gate, jumps out as Jeff is coming around. We're not sure why. Maybe he had made some noise or something Jeff was going to investigate. Jumps out from behind the gate to Jeff's backyard. The stabbing happens in this kind of the side yard in front of the gate. Jeff collapses behind a bush on the side of his house, and he walks off quietly, quickly. And then a few seconds later, the SUV drives. He drives the SUV back into the cul-de-sac, parks it in front of Jeff's driveway, and walks over quickly, looks like he's making sure that Jeff's dead and there's not a witness, and then he drives away.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And also, you talk about this incriminating, damning evidence found at his home, but there was also, they take a DNA sample from underneath Jeff's fingernails.
And that's what, it was an interesting thing. I talked about it a little bit, but usually in a situation like this, if you've got that kind of evidence, you've got a car that was in the area, you've got, you know, you've got pretty good idea of a person who had some sort of motive, they would arrest him. But the DA in this case, maybe because he's a public official, I don't know, maybe he's a lawyer, I don't know why, but the DA refused to allow police to arrest him until they got the DNA evidence back from under the skin under Jeff's fingernail, and until it matched Tejas, according to police, did. That was when they were able to go arrest him. And by that time, he'd holed up in his house, had slashed his wrists in the bathtub, was trying to kill himself. They actually sent in a drone to make sure there was no danger to the police officers who were going to knock down the door. And then they eventually got him to come out, put him in an ambulance for his wounds. He's been in the Clark County Detention Center ever since.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear these messages. Now, one of the things that you do, and I guess police obviously would do as well, but for this book, you go into Tejas's background to try to explain this kind of unexplainable behavior.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. The office is so minor and so unknown. Basically, the office is a dozen people that he runs, and he takes over the probate or the office, public administrator, takes over probate cases of people who don't have family members to deal with their estate after they die. And so it's a pretty obscure county office. I'm not sure why they have an elected official as opposed to an appointed official on it. But the office is so obscure that he didn't really, when he was running for office, nobody wrote about it. Nobody looked into it. He actually ended up getting arrested for domestic assault against his wife while he was in office. And no one even picked up on that because it was in city court instead of district court, because it was a minor offense at that point. She wasn't severely injured or anything like that. And nobody covers city court because it's DUIs and domestics. And there's a lot of those in Vegas. And so, but instantly we started the investigative team. So basically the Metro team started following the homicide and the court cases and all that. And the investigative team started digging into who is this guy really? And one of my colleagues did a long profile that found that he had had all kinds of abusive and inappropriate behavior throughout the years, starting at university law at the UNLV law school. He was he'd gotten drunk and made some inappropriate advances at a party, and then made some threats afterwards about suing people and things like that. When he opened up his own private practice after passing the bar, there was really inappropriate conduct with some of the employees. And then when he got into office, it looked like that type of conduct continued. It was a pattern that we only uncovered afterwards, because before that, it was just such a small office that no one was really covering it.
One of the issues that comes up and is a primary part of this book is the challenge for the Review Journal to preserve the confidential sources that they believe should be on Jeff's phone, which is confiscated by the police in their investigation. There is also the issue of four computers at work, or two computers at work, four computers at Jeff's home. So tell us just a little bit about this battle that begins for his devices, electronic devices.
Right. And that's kind of a very important precedential case that we've spent since Jeff's death fighting, and may continue even further on, because there's a lot of back and forth. So basically, they find Jeff's body. There's his iPhone, which at the paper, we're reimbursed. We're given a certain amount every month, but we have our own phone. We do get computers from the paper, but his was in the IT getting repaired. So his work computer wasn't there. But they find the phone in his pocket. They find four computers and a hard drive in his house that were all his personal computers that he used for work. And so at that point, we know his phone is chock full of 40 years of contacts and confidential sources, many of whom probably work in the DA's office and the police, who may want to see those people and may want to know who's talking to Jeff. additionally, his computers probably have drafts of stories, documents he received, tips, emails, that kind of stuff from confidential sources. Police say, okay, they initially look at the phone just to see if there was a text saying, hey, I'm coming to get you, or a meeting or something that would give him a suspect. And after that, we find out that these devices exist. We instantly go to court and get a restraining order to prevent the police from looking at the devices until we can get a ruling on whether there's confidential sources, which we know there are because Jeff worked sources like nobody in this town. And he knew people for 40 years. So there were a lot of people talking to him. And so this ends up being a huge fight. The prosecutor and police contend that we have no right to intervene in the case. We have no standing because A, the devices were not the newspaper's devices. They were Jeff's personal devices. So if anybody could intervene, it'd be his family, who did not intervene to protect his sources. And we argued that because we have a very strong shield law in Nevada, that the shield law protects the reporter after his death and allows the agency or the news organization that he worked for to exert that privilege when he couldn't do it. The shield law would be pretty worthless if you could kill a reporter and then get all of his sources. In November of last year, we won a historic ruling. Basically, the Supreme Court unanimously ruled that, yes, the shield law extends after a reporter's death. Yes, the news organization can exert that privilege on their behalf. And yes, the police can't search those devices without somebody else taking out anything that could be privileged journalistic materials. The fight was very expensive. I don't have an exact figure, but I know in court they talked about $1 million+ on our side. They spent a lot of time on the prosecutors and the police side and hired their counsel and their legal teams. So at that point, once we win, the police department, which has been nothing but obstructionist and fighting for every little thing, because we had initially said, look, let us take out all the confidential sources. We can appoint a judge and a former prosecutor to look at this stuff and find anything that might be relevant to the case, because obviously the prosecutor is arguing that the defendant has a right to discovery on those devices in case there's someone else who could be a suspect, and they wanted nothing to do with it. So the second we win, they call us up and say, okay, why don't you guys look through the, instead of hiring these outside people to do it, why don't you guys look through the devices, tell us what's privileged, and then go from there. And so we've had these devices, but we're still fighting on how much is privileged and what's privileged and how much they're going to ask for and stuff like that. So it's been a long legal battle.
You talk about the long legal battle, despite all of these, the damning evidence, the DNA and all of the other evidence, including the photo of the vehicle. And what is this person's defense? What is he claiming is his defense?
Okay, well, he spoke to me from jail, video link, and his contention is there was a company, a real estate company that was doing things that he felt were inappropriate in probate cases. And state law allows anybody who's not a felon and over 18 to take over a probate case if there's no family, even if they have no connection to the family. And so he felt that there was a real estate company that was inappropriately taking people's houses. And when he was in office, he was fighting to try to get them to stop and try to get them investigated. His contention is that they framed him for Jeff's murder because they wanted him out of office. He was being a nuisance to their business. So they framed him for Jeff's murder. And when I asked him, well, how did the DNA get there? He's like, I don't know. We're still investigating, that kind of thing. But that's his contention. And that is probably going to be his defense from what we could tell so far. That he's after I talked to him, he ended up talking about this in open court. I expect if the trial goes to August, in August, that he will be maintaining that he was set up by this real estate company, which, of course, denies any involvement in the case.
It's very interesting when you talk about Alicia Goodwin, her version of events when she was with his firm and the conversation she had about her religious background. She claims change their relationship irrevocably from that point.
Yeah, so Alicia is one of the people who was filing complaints against Rob Tejas in his office. And he said that, and she had claimed, she was actually the only one who actually filed two formal complaints. Everybody else was just kind of complaining behind the scenes. And she maintained that they had a pretty good relationship until he found out that she was a Mormon. And then he started talking about the Mormon mafia running Nevada and all this other stuff. And so that she felt that, and he reassigned her and basically demoted her and took away all of her job functions. And so she was one of the people who started following him and got the video of him and the other employee in the back seat of the employee's SUV at Outlet Mall, not far from the office. Video that's kind of hard to explain of why you're what kind of professional thing you could be doing in the back seat of a car. And so she had gotten, they'd followed him half a dozen, maybe 9-10 times, and gotten different video that they gave to Jeff. And so that was kind of the beginning of the story. And I suspect, but from Jeff's point of view, I think the video is probably the most damning part of the story, because a lot of it was kind of he said, she said. They claimed that he did these things. He said, no, they're just bad employees. I'm not 100% sure Jeff would have gone forward with the story without the video, but clearly having a subordinate, having an inappropriate relationship with a subordinate, you know, is not appropriate. It's against county rules. And so I think that pushed it over to a story for Jeff. So yeah, Alicia was a key actor in getting Jeff to work on the story. And actually her father had been a source of Jeff's for years and years, because he used to be a Metro detective. And so her father actually reached out to Jeff when other media didn't want to do the story. And that's how they kind of connected with the people who were complaining about Rob Tejas in the public administrator's office.
Now, what is the local, the Las Vegas, and the national and international reaction once they find that a journalist has been killed by this Tejas, and the reasons for the murder itself? How big a story is this, and how does the Review Journal handle it all?
Yeah, so just to be fair, he's accused but not convicted. So we don't know if he killed him until he gets convicted. He's an innocent person. But obviously the reaction was huge. Because I was working closely with Jeff, they asked me to take a lot of the media stuff. So I was on CNN, I was on Fox, I was on various shows, podcasts. Other people talked to big papers, New York Times, LA Times. A lot of papers sent correspondents here. CBS ended up sending people for a week, did a long thing, and then 48 hours more recently did a whole hour on it. It was a big story nationally, internationally, because like I said earlier, last time we could find a government official killing a reporter because of his story was in the 40s in Texas, where a sheriff or assistant sheriff killed a radio reporter who was investigating some of his properties for prostitution. So we're talking about close to 60 or 70 years. All the other journalists who were killed, and there were more than a dozen, were either killed in the mass shooting I mentioned, or were killed by a gang member or a mobster or something like that. So it's extremely, extremely unusual for a government elected official to go this. And you're talking about a guy who has a law degree. He did lose the reelection, possibly, most likely because of Jeff's stories. But if he ended up killing Jeff, it's completely surprising, because it wasn't like this story got him indicted. It wasn't like this story, would prohibit him from going back to legal practice and going on with his life. His wife is stuck behind him, despite the video of him in the car with this woman. So it didn't even break up his family. And so it's surprising if he is the person the police and prosecutors say did it. If he is the one, it's really kind of a head scratcher, because why would you go to that extent? For the damage has already been done. You've lost your re-election. There's nothing anybody can do about that. Killing Jeff doesn't get you back, and it just puts you in more trouble if he did it.
Let's use this as an opportunity to hear these messages. Yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense. And you write about in the book your conversation with Tejas, and you challenge some of the things he says. Can you? It's a pretty dramatic scene. Can you recreate that for us somewhat?
Yeah, sure. You know, I sit down with him. It's in a loud room because there's other people talking to their friends and family who've been arrested over video links. I'm trying to put my recorder to my ear and still ask questions. And so I want to, you know, I went there assuming he didn't want to talk about the case. I wanted to learn a little bit more about him. And then he said, no, I don't want to talk to you about my personal history because I might want to work on a book with someone. Right. And I said, okay. And I said, well, what are we doing here then? Because he has to approve the interview. You can't just show up and force him to do an interview. So I had to lie through police to do it. He goes, well, let's talk about the case. And first he wanted to relitigate whether or not he was a bad boss and whether or not Jeff's stories were fair and accurate.
Right.
And then I said, well, do you want to talk about the murder case? And he says, yeah, I mean, I'm innocent. I would never do anything like that. I'm a good person. You know, I've made mistakes in my past. I, you know, choked my wife, but I was drinking and I was an alcoholic. So I stopped drinking after that. And I admit making mistakes in, you know, other parts of my life, but who hasn't? But I would never kill anybody. And that's when he comes out and said, and I said, well, who does? And we had heard some inklings that he was going to blame this real estate company. And I said, well, who did it? And he starts talking about the real estate company and that he set him up. And I said, look, Rob, who's going to believe that? I mean, it's very unlikely, not only that they would kill someone, but it's very unlikely that if they wanted to get rid of you, they would just kill you instead of the person who was basically responsible for taking you out of office. And then he says, well, if they killed me, then the investigation would have snowballed on them. And here they were able to make me look like I'm crazy. And took me out. And I said, but, you know, you were already kind of out. They only had to wait 3 months before your time in office is done. And then I said, well, what happened with, you know, where were you? He's like, oh, I was at home alone because his cell phone was at home. And because he left it at home because cell phones can be tracked, right? If he ends up being convicted as a killer, he's smart enough to leave his cell phone at home so it wouldn't be tracked to the site.
Right.
He said, I was just at home alone. How'd they get your DNA? Well, I don't know, but you know, and I said, you know, the figure looks kind of like you. And he goes, yeah, well, that person could have just planted the DNA after the stabbing. And so he could never really explain how they got DNA from him to plant even, which would be a really difficult thing for some random person to get somebody else's DNA,
sure.
Especially skin scraping. It's one thing to get them, you know, follow them to a Starbucks and grab their coffee cup after they throw it away. But that's not what they, according to police, what they found. So yeah, it was an interesting, I found it very interesting because he was saying stuff that was very hard to believe, but he was very earnest about it and didn't appear to be out of his mind. He just had this story that I think a lot of people who've heard it were pretty incredulous about it. So it was, I'm surprised he talked to me. He's been talking to a lot of reporters, was kind of surprised that he would lay that all out there before the trial because, you know, gives the prosecutors and police an idea of where he's going to go.
You also say it's unusual for a person like him in his situation to also speak to other media, but he had also granted interviews to other media. If I'm not correct, he also granted an interview to an RJ reporter, Newberg, if I'm not correct.
Yeah, Caitlin has talked to him several times, and he's talked to her repeatedly about the case because she's the one kind of like on the ground. She's our courts reporter. She's a really good reporter, hardworking, really dedicated. And she's been following this case from the day he was arrested. And he ended up talking to a TV station. So she decided to try. And sure enough, he was okay. I'm not sure if he turned down any of his requests. I went an additional step to ask for his visitor logs for the book just to see who was visiting him. And there was number of reporters. He ended up talking to 48 hours on camera when they did the big piece, the hour long piece on the RJ's reaction and RJ's work after Jeff's murder. So he has been very unusual for a suspect to do this. A lot of it probably extends to the fact that most of the time he's represented himself and he's gone through several attorneys.
Mm-hmm.
But he's continuing to talk, even though he has a pretty high profile defense attorney who's pretty credible. you know, most defense attorneys tell you not to talk, right? Don't talk to police. Definitely don't talk to the media. But he's ignoring that and wants to be have his voice heard in it. And so we obviously are more than happy to allow him to put his side out there.
Was the Review Journal involved at all in the investigation of his claim that he was indigent despite owning properties?
Yeah, so I did that story. So basically, the way the law works is you get a public defender only if you're completely indigent. You have no resources, you have no income, you have nothing in the bank account. So I had gotten a tip after he had signed that paper claiming that. He had written on the paper that he had some rental properties, but there's no other information about it. And there was no sense of whether they were worth anything. So I had gotten a tip that some of these rental properties are in Hot Springs. And so I was able to track them down, but basically it was an blind LLC, so I couldn't find anything. What I did is I called up the tax collector's office in Hot Springs and said, hey, are you guys ever send tax bills to Rob Tejas's address in Las Vegas? I knew his address. And they said, yeah, here it is. And on those tax bills were the properties, right? So it was clear that they were his. In fact, the day after my story ran, a police source that I have fairly high up called me up and was like, how the heck did you get that? We've been looking for those properties for weeks. And so, yeah, he had several properties worth quite a bit of money. He ended up selling them recently to pay for this attorney. He had some money in the bank. His wife was still making money. So we questioned, we wrote a story questioning why taxpayers were paying for his legal defense. And a few days later, he ended up dropping his public defender. I don't know. I doubt it's because of our story. He's been going through attorneys. I think he went through four or five different attorneys. But when he wanted a public defender again, the judge finally did the right thing and held an indigency hearing and said that he couldn't have it because he does have resources. He has property, he has a house, he has family who has money. And so he ended up having to pay for his own attorney and went through a few more and now has a new attorney that he got recently.
Who is the new attorney that he has?
Draskovich. He's a pretty high profile criminal defense attorney, has done a lot of cases and has had some pretty good success of getting people mistrials and things like that. He has quite a bit of credibility. Some of the other attorneys he hired were good attorneys, but didn't have the experience in high-profile murder cases that the attorney has now. But the issue is how much of the attorney's advice is Rob Tejas really listening to if he's still agreeing to talk to reporters. So obviously the attorney has attorney-client privilege. He can't talk to us about his interactions there, but it seems like Rob is very in control and in charge. He's a lawyer. He didn't do any serious criminal work. He was a probate lawyer. I think he did DUI or something, but he's definitely knows what he wants. He believes, or at least he says it repeatedly, that he believes he's going to walk out of there after the trial. He wanted the trial to happen in March because he thought that he was going to be acquitted and why spend any more time at the Clark County Detention Center sitting there with no bail. It's going to be an interesting case in that it would be interesting to see what his attorney does and what kind of defense he puts up.
It's interesting. In representing himself, he is doing, I think, in his mind that he is also representing himself as an attorney might in a high profile case like this, trying to somehow affect the jury pool with his interviews that he does.
Yes, that's possible. Or he doesn't want, you know, the problem with not speaking to the media is then you have a no comment and your side is never out. So I think he's hoping to get his side out into the media. Maybe some juries will hear it. Maybe they won't. It also kind of locks him into a story because I knew full well when I was talking to him that the police were recording this conversation on video link. And I'm sure as an attorney, he's not stupid. He knows that's happening. So now he has at least his legal strategy out there and prosecutors can look for ways to thwart it well before the case comes to trial. I don't know for a fact, but I suspect that some of his issues with changing attorneys where they were telling him, look, Rob, the case is pretty overwhelming. you should try to, we should try to get you a plea so you don't spend the rest of your life in prison. And he doesn't want to do it. He's maintaining his innocence and he has a right to a trial. The question of the matter is how effective is his defense going to be with what he has put out there? And, you know, juries are unpredictable. You know, we just had OJ die and we all remember what happened in that case. Sure. I think most people thought he was going to be convicted and he was absolved of the murder. So you never know. I mean, maybe he has a story that will appeal to the jury. We'll have to see when it actually goes to trial, because it doesn't look like he's going to take a plea of any sort.
When is the trial scheduled for? Do you know?
It's scheduled now for first Monday in August, the 5th of August, but it was supposed to happen in March. And the reason it didn't happen in March is because we were still, the RJ was still reviewing Jeff's devices for what could and couldn't be privileged as far right. as sources and journalistic materials. And so initially he wanted to go forward without that, but then the prosecutors wanted the stuff. And then I think his attorney convinced him to delay it until August. So as soon as we have an agreement with police and prosecutors on what we turn over and we don't turn over, a bunch of us are going to be, there's a dozen of us who have been authorized by the court to look at the devices, find out where the sources and the privileged material is that police and prosecutors can't look at.
Oh, very interesting. What we haven't mentioned, though, in this, and just to sort of wrap up this story, mm-hmm. is the injuries that Jeff Gehrman endured right in his front yard of his home and wasn't found by the neighbor till the next day covered in blood. But right away, right. his carotid artery was slashed. And he was stabbed in the neck three times, but then three times in the torso as well. So this was, as you write, a brutal and gruesome murder in revenge for an article written in a newspaper. And you explain throughout this book the dangerous characters that Jeff Gehrman dared to write about. Mob figures, even one mob figure said, "I will kill you," after mm-hmm. writing an article. So he was a fearless, with great integrity, this journalist, and you do write about his enduring legend, what his reputation was as a journalist after the news of his murder.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, big thing for us is when we got the autopsy report, we wanted to know if he suffered. Did he lay there for 12 hours, 24 hours before he died, just immobilized? Fortunately, all the experts thought he probably was dead before he fell because those injuries were so severe. He was able to scratch the suspect, allegedly, according to police, and get DNA. His legacy, he's definitely, I call him the quintessential Las Vegas journalist. He'd been there for 40 years. His killing, he was inducted in the Hall of Fame by the Nevada Press Association. And he, you know, he basically, he tracked Vegas. He was almost like a historian. His stories tracked Vegas through the late 70s to the current time, which was one of the most interesting times in Vegas, because that's when the mob was pushed out and when the corporations kind of took over the casinos. He definitely will be missed, and he definitely has a place in the history of this town that he's created through his hard work and his digging and his tenacity.
Tell us about, when you talk about his legacy, murder in Sin City, and also the podcast Mobbed Up.
Right. So he had always wanted to write a book. There was a guy, Benny Binion was the guy I talked about earlier, who had created Binion's Horseshoe and been a big casino owner downtown, very checkered history. His son was running the casino because after a while, Benny's history didn't allow him to have a license. But his son had some similar problem, or had not similar problems. He had different problems. He had a drug addiction. He was divorced, ended up moving in with a woman who had a boyfriend of her own, and then he was found dead. They initially thought it was a drug overdose, but then police and prosecutors decided that the woman and her boyfriend had killed him for the money, because the boyfriend was caught digging up a bunch of silver and chips, casino chips and other valuables in the desert outside of Pahrump, which is about 60 miles away. And so Jeff covered the case. He was a course reporter for The Sun and ended up writing a book called Murder in Sin City. about this case. It ended up being a really high profile case. There was actually a few books written about it, but his was made into a made for TV movie with some pretty well-known actors and actresses. More recently, this is our third season. We have a podcast. RJ produces a podcast called Mobbed Up, pretty popular podcast. Wired magazine called it one of the best crime podcasts, and it gets a lot of listeners. And basically, every season is one section of what the mob's history is in Las Vegas. And Jeff did season two, reluctantly at first, but we all think he did a really good job. In fact, he won a Nevada Press Association Award after his death for season two of Mobbed Up as the best podcast. He talked about his experiences covering the mob and the purchase of the Aladdin. There was a big fight between Johnny Carson and Wayne Newton about who would purchase the property. And so that was his season of, and there was a lot of recollections. He talked a little bit about that punch by the bailiff who was working for the loan shark. And it was, I remember that as being a very emotional press association awards because we were there. I had won a substantial number of awards, but the big thing was him being inducted in the Hall of Fame and him getting an award for the podcast that he didn't want to do, but ended up really loving and getting a lot of publicity for and a lot of accolades for. And it was really well done. It's worth listening to. You can hear Jeff's voice still.
Absolutely. You considered Jeff a respected colleague, and this book, tell us what the purpose of this book is. We talked about at the very beginning the promise you made to Jeff if anything were to happen, but tell us about the promise of this book for you.
So that meeting that we had before, about a week before his death, I talked to him. He go, hey, that Rob Tejas guy, he's pretty upset. He's tweeting about you and you took him out of office. You better watch your back, which was kind of our little gallows joke. And he goes, well, you better write about it if anything happens. And I'm like, yeah. Of course not. Assuming nothing happened. We did this a dozen times, right? After he was killed, I decided that even though that promise was in jest, that I would keep that promise. It was important, A, to keep the promise. B, and more importantly, to tell Jeff's story as a cautionary tale about what can happen when government corruption and government malfeasance is exposed. And if police and prosecutors are right, the person who got exposed didn't like it. And so I definitely wanted to show his life, his career, and what happened to him so people would understand it. And that's kind of what the last story is all about, Jeff's last story.
Absolutely. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about your book, The Last Story, The Murder of an Investigative Journalist in Las Vegas. So could you tell us where they might find out more information about this book and the publisher? Could you tell us about that?
So The Last Story is on will be published August 30th. It's already on Amazon for pre-order, both Kindle and the hardcover and a paperback too. And I think there's going to be an audio book coming out. You can see my page on Wild Blue Press, where the book, you can also link to the book, and you can follow me on Twitter at Arthur M. Kane. M is my middle initial, like Mary. Arthur M. Kane is my Twitter handle. And obviously, even though I rarely write for the RJ anymore because I'm an editor, you can see my work, my bio there, and the work of my reporters on the investigative team.
Thank you so much, Arthur Kane, The Last Story, The Murder of an Investigative Journalist in Las Vegas. Thank you so much for this interview, and you have a great evening. Good night.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you.